Hi, I'm Trevor Elio.
And I'm Julie Stern, and this is Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts to uncover the concepts and patterns that help us organize our world.
From farming to fashion, we can understand any field through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships. We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. If you're interested in our work, you can find out more at edtosavetheworld.com. This week on Conceptually Speaking, we welcome Rafael Anjau, a language educator and founder of the Ampersand Consulting Group. To say that Rafael is passionate about world language is a bit of an understatement. When we first shared the learning transfer mental model with him, he sent us back a PDF exploring anchoring concepts in no less than 8 different languages. Impressive as that is, what really made Rafael a compelling guest was the beauty and artistry with which he spoke about communication. For him, learning other languages is about much more than memorizing terms and conjugating verbs. It's about finding the heart of other cultures, regions, and countries. It's about sharing and connecting through stories, values, and communication.
Anyone that learns a language to understand that by learning my language, for example, Spanish, my mother tongue, they're getting access to my culture. They're getting access to my value system. They're getting access to the way that I conceive the truth. They're getting access to the narratives that shape my upbringing in many different ways. So audience gives us that. Once we recognize the age first, then we start creating citizens who are learning a different language to be active people at their age in the world. And when we recognize their purpose, that automatically helps us to curate the tools, the resources that will make them think.
Rafael's ability to capture the essence of communication and language is inspiring. Whether you're a polyglot or a monolingual like myself, this episode is rich with wisdom about the power of language, meaning, and identity. We hope you enjoy. Our guest this week is Rafael Anjau. He's a language teacher with a passion for interdisciplinary learning and is the co-founder of the Ampersand Consulting Group. Welcome, Rafael.
Thank you, Trevor. It's a pleasure to be with both of you.
Awesome, awesome. So I'm so excited to have Rafael on with us today. He and I met really on Twitter. Funny story, Trevor and I met on Twitter as well. and so we've been following each other's work. And then was it 2 years ago, Rafa, that we presented together in Melbourne? I just, via Twitter, I said, hey, I'm going to be doing this conference at a school in Melbourne. We're looking for people to lead breakout groups. And would you come? And people had to pay their own way. So I had no intention of him saying yes, but he said yes. So it's so wonderful to be have you on the podcast. It's going to be hard for me not to break into Spanish. Trevor, you have to edit out if he and I start speaking Spanish to each other all of a sudden. But Rafael is a true linguist and someone I turn to for helping people understand conceptual learning in world language and modern language and language acquisition settings. He's influenced my thinking a lot. You know, Rafa, that blog I wrote about 8 misconceptions of language learners or something where I quoted you. It was like a top blog of 2018 for Share My Lesson. I feel like it really resonated with people. So I'm super excited to have you here. And what's cool about Rafael is he's from Mexico. So of course he speaks Spanish. Of course he speaks English. We're all speaking English now. But you lived in China for a while. Yeah.
I did. Yes.
And now you're in Dubai in the Middle East. And so he sent us this, one of the most amazing documents I've ever seen of our little process of acquire, connect, and transfer concepts for I think was maybe 7 to 9 different languages. Is that what you?
That is correct.
It was incredible. So welcome. We're super excited to have you to the show. Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself for our listeners to know a bit more about who you are?
Absolutely, Julie. And thank you. And I will consider this interaction between Trevor, you and I as a celebration of our 3rd anniversary, because I think this coming May, it's going to be 3 years that I met you in person
in
Melbourne.
Right.
Yes,
that's right. Awesome.
One thing that I appreciate about me as a person and as a learner, Julie and Trevor, is that I think I'm a very curious person. And the fact that I gave you information for eight different languages is an example of that. Once somebody tickles my brain and starts speaking my brain and my brain starts making connections, I just become hungrier and hungrier. I'm one of those people that starts inquiring into something and discovers something else. Curiosity is it's a big part of my life. And as somebody that consumes a lot of information in different languages, I am always fascinated by similarities rather than differences. Really, it's the similarities, the commonalities among people, among subject groups, pieces of knowledge and experiences that they give meaning to my life. And as a woman, you saw the first edition of my books. Now you know me, and I think if you read between the lines, you can even see the amount of autobiographical or experiential and even empirical part in those resources that I created. So yeah, that's who I am. I am a learner at heart. I will always be a learner. I don't think I'll ever stop being a student.
Same. Trevor and I are the same. So it's wonderful to have you in this conversation. So we always ask our guests to give us these 3 to 5 concepts that kind of anchor our conversation. So would you mind listing them? So if we're the topic is language acquisition or language learning, or what would be your 3 to 5 words? Do you mind sharing them? And then we'll go one by one.
Not at all, Julie. The 5 choices that I have are purpose, audience, message, relationships, and contribution.
Oh, I love that. I can't wait to dive into all of them. So when I hear purpose and audience and message, for sure, I think of English language arts. What we think of as, you know, what's really cool is that I feel like people always thought of English and literature and students learning that in schools as one discipline. And then modern languages, world languages, language acquisition is another one. But there's so many similarities because really at the heart is communication. And so maybe we could just start with those first 2, purpose and audience. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you chose those?
Absolutely. Purpose, I guess it's the reason why, Julia. One of the fascinating things about world languages is choosing which one. Mm-hmm. Why? Why do I want to learn English? Mm-hmm. Why do I want to learn French? How is that going to contribute to my development as a person, as a learner, as a professional, as a citizen of the world? Mm-hmm. And understanding that why at a personal level, it's very important for anyone who wants to pick up a different language. And for us educators to understand why children are in our classroom as well. Because many times students would say, you know, I'm learning Spanish in an international scenario because I want to study university in the States. And that's the second most spoken language. And that's the reason. So you pretty much, when you hear this information, you know where they would want to go and how you may contribute to their journey. Mm. But there are other reasons, other whys that are a lot deeper, such as I love Hispanic literature. Mm. I watch cinema in Spanish and it helps me to do these things. So when children share these stories with you, then your classroom stops being homogenous. It becomes a very heterogeneous collection of human beings with different purposes. And the question that this creates in my head is, what are they going to do with my language? Mm. And what can I do to create a learning scenario for them to really, really, really look at my language as a tool, as an extension to their intellect and personal and human experience, and as an opportunity for them to become contributors to the information in my language, pretty much in the same way that I became an English speaker and that I am contributing in a small way to pedagogy in English.
Wow.
So that's purpose.
I knew we were going to get deep real fast, but I love it. I love this idea that purpose, I thought something else. You mean, what is the purpose of the children wanting to learn this language? Right there, boom.
That is correct.
You reconfigured my thinking about that word. I love it.
And I appreciate, Raphael, the immediate depth that you bring into this conversation, because typically I feel like that would be something that people would ask down the line. Because when I think about, you know, early in my own personal experience with world languages, you know, entering into the classroom, it feels like it's a very sort of utilitarian view of language. Like, you know, you need to learn how to ask how to go to the bathroom when you are in a foreign country. You know, it's not this the sort of depth that you were sort of suggesting here, which is, you know, by acquiring understanding of another language, you're giving somebody the tools to become a participant in that culture and to share their story with people who otherwise might not have heard it. So no, that's fantastic. So could you maybe talk about the relationship between the purpose of that person learning the language and then the audience they're going to share it with?
Yeah, absolutely. And before I go into that relationship, Trevor, if I may, you know, one of the reasons why I chose audience is this idea that that I like to cater to different ages, just in the same way that we cater food. I will never teach the same things to a younger learner than to a teenager than to an adult learner. And when I say that I would not teach the same, that comes with an added touch of why am I teaching this? Let me give you an example to elaborate on this idea. I have never understood, for example, why there is this obsession of teaching the climate and the timetable, you know, the subjects that we study to children in primary school. I've never heard a primary student talking about those things. And still, all the courses for world languages that we have teach them that. So it's like we want to make them talk about that. So they are not designed with a sense of audience. Another thing, you know, when we teach teenagers, we teach them, I mean, Julie, I don't know if you experienced this when you were learning Spanish, how to order food in a restaurant. And after you teach that drill, like the conversation stops there. Like we go to restaurants just to order food and then everything stops. When the real purpose of going to a restaurant and order food is what happens later. So audience to me means what kind of learning do I have to design to really give these children, these young adults, these adults, a reason to understand that the language that they're picking up right now, they will find a meaning for using already. And understanding their purpose with the people that they are, you know, recognizing them as an audience, really gives me the tools to design something that is exploratory for them, something that is exploratory for me, and that in combination becomes a lesson of chemistry, of life, really. Because ultimately, I want anyone that learns a language to understand that they're by learning my language, for example, Spanish, my mother tongue, they're getting access to my culture. They're getting access to my value system. They're getting access to the way that I conceive the truth. They're getting access to the narratives that shape my upbringing in many different ways. So audience gives us that. Once we recognize the age first, then we start creating citizens who are learning a different language to be active people at their age in the world. And when we recognize their purpose, that automatically helps us to curate the tools, the resources that will make them think. I even went ahead, Trevor, last year as to asking like over 1,000 students on many parts of the world, what are the things that you talk about? Because I wanted to figure out what if I were to write a new edition of my books, which I did, I want to have themes that are representative of the ages that I'm designing learning for. And what I found is that everything that we think about in school is the last thing that they care about. Yes.
The timetable. They do not care about the timetable.
No, you know, what things that they are interested right now, you know, like fear, Judy, you'd be surprised at how high in the list fear, relationships, what it means to love somebody.
Indeed, indeed.
Yes.
I had this down as one of my questions before we started recording, was I wanted to ask you about the age difference, because that's something that I talk to a lot of teachers about around the world when I'm leading these breakout sessions for language acquisition teachers. It seems like we all want them to learn sort of the vocabulary of the classroom, or, you know, things like that. And one thing that you said that really influenced my work with teachers is you said, I wanted to go beyond the foods and the festivals. I'm not sure if you remember that quote, but I that was mic drop for me, because so often we, like, you know, we make some tacos, we wear a sombrero, and we have this little party, and it's so superficial. It's so superficial. And so I love that. I'm so glad to hear you say, what is the age of the students, and what do they care about? What do they want to talk about? You might want to do, for little kids, you might want to do a whole unit on animals and insects, but you probably don't want to do that for, you know, older children. And so I actually learned as an adult. And because I went through, like everybody probably listening to this podcast, I went through several years of having Spanish in secondary school, and then I could barely say anything. And college. And I went through that 2 semesters in college, and I could barely say anything. And so it wasn't until my husband joined the Foreign Service, and they thankfully gave the same super intense, really world-class instruction to spouses. And we had to learn diplomacy. So I was speaking like about nuclear weapons and things like that, because that was the topic for diplomacy. So we had to, the spouses, who some of us cared and some of us didn't, we had to learn the language of diplomacy, because that was the course. But it was so great to learn. So there are certain words that I only know in Spanish. And every time I read them in a news article, my brain reads them in Spanish, because I learned content while I learned Spanish. And I'm wondering what you think about that. Like, do you ask teachers to teach kids content while they learn the language?
That's one of the things that I advocate for, Julie, and the experience that you've just shared is pretty much what confirms this idea of purpose. Some students have come up to say, you know, I don't want to learn about what I don't want you to teach me what I did last week, yeah, or to tell you how I celebrated my birthday. No, teach me the language of the arts. I would like to talk about art. Mm. Teach me the language of cinema. I would like to discuss movies with people. Mm. Some people really have a clear vision of how they want to use language. Some of these young people are very active in their social media. They have a persona. They create content, Julie. This is the era we were living. Yes. Children are no longer silent. That idea of writing a blog entry or a journal entry, keeping it in your notebook, it's history already. Mm-hmm. Children are producers of information. So teaching them content we empower them to really use everything they know and to communicate that idea with the people that they have identified as their audience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what more beautiful thing that getting students to be at learning language at a very basic level, but not to feel insulted intellectually by getting me as a teacher to teach them all these simple things that they will only say once.
Insulted intellectually. I love that. I'm going to quote you on that one.
And it's so odd that you bring that up, because like, it almost feels like such a non-starter that you would not consider purpose and audience right away when you are learning a tool for communication, because that shapes everything in every conversation that you have. Like, never do you have a completely decontextualized conversation unless you're writing like an incredibly, you know, academic paper or something. When you're thinking about just like language in use that happens every day when people are communicating and sharing, you're always keeping those things in mind. So it is very strange to consider the fact that we begin in this weird decontextualized space. And then, as you were saying, it sounds like as kids gain more expertise, only then are they given a context to root their language acquisition and learning in, which just feels very backwards now that you say it. Why do you think that is? Why is it that so many world language curriculum begin in this sort of mushy, squishy, decontextualized world and feel like they can't get to the language in use until later?
One of the things that I found, Trevor, when I was when I started to inquire into the reasons why people have learned languages historically, I came across, you know, learning a language because of conflict, war, learning a language because of exchange programs, learning a language for business, learning a language to get a scholarship. That was my reality in Mexico back in the day. Learning a language because I will get a better job, because I will get a better salary. And many times right now we are at the level of cooperation, Trevor, where a lot of young people are learning a language because they want to cooperate with other cultures, with individuals with different histories, and because they want to have an active part in the world. And if we consider their cultural background, Trevor, for example, somebody who is Korean or Japanese or Chinese, they have these honorific degrees of addressing people that may not exist in European languages. So they may ask a question, you know, how would you say, how do you do? But to speaking to a stranger who is older than me. And those nuances, we may not, in Spanish, I would say, use usted, you know, just the formal word. But if this person understands the meaning of usted, or vous in French, they would say, no, but that's not really what I want. It's not formal. I just want to honor age. And this is, you know, when we have to understand that the way that we see audience when we produce a paper, in some other cultures, they may see it as the person that is being the recipient of what is coming out of my mouth, of my message. So even in very simple interactions, can we have this? And if I look at it the other way around, you know, I think if I were speaking Korean, some of my mistakes would be because I would be my lack of understanding of the audience that I am addressing. And that's where I would have to really, really work on understanding the nuances of how the Korean society structures communication among people of different age groups.
That's so interesting. I mean, I like you, I love to learn language. I only speak Spanish as my other language, but I just feel like that experience in and of itself allowed me to respect so much the nuance of language and how you can only truly understand someone's worldview through learning their exact language. I think it's nice to promote that to hear that you're saying young people want to collaborate, because a lot of times I hear people say, oh, well, you know, by the time these kids are old enough, you'll be able to just throw a little Google Translate in your ear and, you know, have these full conversations. And it's not the same. It's really not the same. Even if the technology improves, I think these nuances that you're talking about are really what makes learning the language worthwhile.
That's such a good point, Julie, about like, and I think the same about when we talk about how kids can just Google any fact. So they don't need to know anything anymore. And it is this very kind of instrumentalized way of looking at things that I think is kind of captures our neoliberal moment, where, you know, if you like, I feel like when I've seen those commercials or people talking about Google, it's like some, you know, rich kid on vacation and he's like, oh, I want to know how to get to the art museum so I can ask someone, which is a very different sort of experience with language and communication than immersing yourself, as Rafael was saying, in the culture so you can understand those sort of nuances of language. So there's a very different, it seems like it's very different communicating to be understood and then learning a language to understand the culture from which it comes. And I think that that's a really important difference. And I am very much a sort of dilettante in thinking and learning about this, but a book that I'm listening to right now is audiobook is talking about the saber whorf hypothesis, which is this idea that language has a way of kind of shaping and creating what we sort of perceive in the world around us. And it sounds like it doesn't necessarily cut off potential reality, but it does kind of shape the things that we pay attention to and the sort of way that we perceive and create reality and meaning. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. It seems like you're kind of beginning to allude to the fact that there are these sort of cultural nuances that shape the way that we use language. It's not just about communication. You have to be aware of the cultural context in which it's used. So could you talk more about, and maybe there's some commonalities, maybe there's some differences globally. So could you maybe discuss a little bit of how that might look?
Sure, Trevor. I think this actually brings me to the next word that I chose, relationships, is that the relationship that we form with the language. I think that I am funnier in English than I am in Spanish, Trevor, for some strange reason. And I think it has to do with how much language for entertainment I consumed as I was learning English, that it just made my brain more agile for joking around. And I don't know, I think all the cultural references in the English language when people are joking is what attracted me.
Interesting.
In Spanish, I feel I'm a grammar Nazi in Spanish. I feel I have to speak properly all the time. Mm. In French, somebody told me that when I speak French, I sound like one of these African mamas with a big colorful hat because of my thick accent in French. And in French, I actually feel like that. I actually feel colorful. So it's a very interesting observation. In Italian, I want to feel that I am a chef, but of course I am not. So I have developed a certain persona with the languages that I have learned. In Chinese, people listen to me, and I'm not fluent in Chinese, Julie, Trevor. I only know how to communicate what I need, but I think I say it, I communicate things with so much ease and certainty that people just think, oh, are you Chinese? No, I look Chinese, but I'm not. So these relationships that we form, I believe that they have, maybe, possibly, they have to do with that element of the language that attracted us. In my case, English, from English, humor, pop culture, music, cinema, that had to do a lot with me. Young literature in English is a big part of my life, has always been a big part of my life. From French, music, cinema, from Italian language, food. And in Spanish, you know, literature in Spanish tends to be very serious. So I guess that I went deeper into that relationship. There are times when I am writing in English when I am processing thoughts in Spanish. There are times when I am writing or speaking Spanish and I have English in the back of my head, playing with structures that do not exist in the other. So I have become, I think, a very flexible thinker, a very flexible speaker, to the point that sometimes when I cannot express something in Spanish, I think it in English and then translate it.
Wow. So interesting. Everything that you just said is so interesting. I love that your concept, the word relationships, is the sort of speaker's relationship with the language, and that you can almost have these different personas based on the language and even be funnier. I think because I have a lot of friends who are their native language is Spanish, but they tell me, you know, Julie, even when we're all together, sometimes if we're speaking about something really heavy, we switch to English because the words are so much more precise that they're all native Spanish speakers. And when they're having fun, they all speak Spanish. But if they're like getting into this real heated political discussion, sometimes they'll switch to English because the words are more precise. And I just found that so fascinating that, you know, different languages communicate different things. And I think another thing I wanted to share that I love about living in multiple countries where the same language is spoken. I lived in Colombia, which a lot of people say is like the, you know, outside of Spain, the most sort of pure, quote unquote, of Spanish. And then I lived, and it was gorgeous Spanish. And we all spoke pretty, pretty beautiful Spanish. And we would go around and people would say, oh, you have a lindo Colombian accent, a cute Colombian accent. And then I lived in the Dominican Republic, which is the Caribbean and very similar to where I'm from, which is Louisiana. I'm from New Orleans. And so, you know, just the whole atmosphere of the Caribbean is more laid back. And the other day we were on a call with my kid's school and something happened. And the head of the school, who's really formal and she's amazing, she said OMG, but she pronounced OMG like oh my god in Spanish. I couldn't stop laughing. She said OMG, and I just thought, only in Dominican. I mean, to me, I would love to almost start there with kids to say, you know, give them these little linguistic things to say, where do you think they would say this? Because Dominicans have such a tie to the United States, but Colombians, you know, they don't really, well, there's some political ties to the United States, of course, but Colombians culturally don't have as much of an affinity to the United States as Dominicans. And so I don't think I'd ever hear OMH in Colombia. They're also more formal. So it was just this little nuance. And so I wish that language teachers would also sort of present these little tidbits to kids earlier on. I feel like a lot of times language teachers say, I need them to master the basics before we can talk about culture, before we can talk about nuance. What do you think about that?
I was actually writing a note as you were talking, Aunt Julie, about why waiting? There's so many useful expressions. You know, now you speak Spanish. I mean, in Trevor, you're familiar with Italian. You know, with the subjunctive. It's extremely popular, but you have to wait a few years until teachers start teaching you that. And when you get to start learning those structures, they tell you, oh, it's very difficult, and there's so many restrictions, and there's so many exceptions. And then you become frustrated and anxiety appears. And the point is that all of these expressions are so natural and so useful that if we start just using them through frequency, children will acquire them. So if we really want to start teaching languages constructively, we have to start adopting an approach that gives children things that are mixable. Ingredients to mix, ingredients to cook, so that they design their own recipes instead of just giving them bricks to construct a wall. And that comes with a metaphor, by the way. So it's pretty interesting, you know, that right now, if I start looking at the function that words or chunks of words have, it's easier for me to help students construct meaning than if I teach them isolated words that then later on they will have to figure out how to combine. When we teach in chunks through functions, there is music already aligned to it. There is already a certain intentionality. And there is the idea that you only have to put this in front.
Yeah, I love that because I feel like I just wrote we're doing these unit storyboards. I think I shared with you our new online course, and yes. I wrote one for Spanish just because, you know, I'm the most skilled, I guess, in foreign language on the team so far. I wrote, you know, a beginner Spanish one about my preferences because I was thinking for like middle school age students. And I can see teachers being like, no, but gustar is something very different. I like, or this pleases me is something very different. And I cannot teach that until after I've taught sort of regular verb conjugation, because that one is special. And I'm just thinking, God, they're like, these kids are like 12, 13, 14 years old. You know, they're not thinking in this sort of logical order. But I feel like a lot of language teachers think I'm like a heretic because I would teach gustar before I would teach sort of these normal verbs. But I'm just thinking, if a middle schooler wants to talk about what they like and what they don't like. So I'm wondering what you think about that. Am I a heretic?
You are not, Julie. Yeah, you know, you and I are in the same team, Julie. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point, for example, that I don't even teach conjugations in Spanish because conjugation is musical and it has a strong relationship with pattern. So instead of having students reciting ending of words endlessly to the point that they get a headache, I ask them to read stories in which all the verbs end in the same way. And this just makes them absorb the pattern of conjugation. And when I choose the verbs that I feel are a good idea to teach, I mostly go for verbs that, when combined, allow them to create ideas that will make them feel smart. Not that will make them sound like an ad on television. I agree with the verb gustar, for example, because you can add any verb you want in front of it. I like the one of the things that I do in Spanish is I take the idea of the modal verbs in English, must, should, could, and all of these verbs in Spanish are a different mode, a different tense, if you like. And because after that, you can add any other verb in infinitive form. And if I say you should study Spanish, you must study Spanish, you could study Spanish, there is a different intention in each combination, Julie. And when we give students this plethora of possibilities, this is when we're giving them choice to convey messages instead of just writing or uttering statements.
I've heard the word pattern multiple times, and I keep reflecting on my own experience. I took Latin in high school, and I was horrendous at it. So I took Italian in college, took 3 semesters. And I also very, very, did very poorly in that course too. I am incredibly fascinated by language and communication. So I've always like sort of wondered where that breakdown is. And this idea of pattern, and that book I was referring to earlier, I was blanking on the title. It's The Patterning Instinct by Jeremy Lent. Mm-hmm. And this idea of pattern as a means to learn language is something that I feel like I did not get in my own sort of language education. I have ADHD. So when it comes to memorizing things, my brain is literally like, we're not too good at that. But when it comes to sort of fluid pattern recognition, like that's like one of my superpowers. So I feel like I was trying to cram all of these words in my head and they just were not sticking because I did not have, you know, as Hattie says, the coat hangers to hang them on. I didn't have those mm-hmm. structures and patterns. But if I would have maybe learned the language in a way that tapped into those patterns that I knew and recognized in the English language, maybe I would have had an easier time with it. So that does seem to be a pretty ubiquitous thing, why is it that we feel like one must memorize and accumulate before they can think about those larger, broader patterns within language? Where does that come from? And could you maybe combat that myth a little bit?
I think that the work that you, Trevor and Judy, are doing, you know, trying to organize things, it means a lot to me and many other educators, because we appreciate that, because we see patterns. And I don't think a lot of teaching and learning tools are organized in that manner. They're organized almost in sequential manner, a sequence mm-hmm. that I do not know who created it and what's the rationale behind. Seriously, I could argue so much about the order of topics in teaching English as an additional language. But if we really want to accelerate acquisition and again, ignite and empower students to recognize that they can do it, that it's doable, we have to really organize the learning or the information in a way that they see, okay, so if all of this is the same, I don't have to really memorize. I will have to follow the music, at least in Spanish. Julie, you may understand this. And Trevor, you, with the Italian that you took it in college, you will too. Let me give you an example about the texts that I share with students with any time tense. I ask them to read texts about a girl, and that's a third person singular, and then about a boy, that's a third person singular. And then we talk about those that boy and that girl. And we are repeating the same pronunciation all the time. We're repeating the same pattern, the same music. Then I change, okay, let's speak about both of them. And in Spanish, we only have to add an N. So they notice the music, oh, there is a change now. And now we can speak about 3 different individuals. And when that happens, then I change to you. Okay, let's speak about you. And this is how I do the conjugations. Pure communication throughout in all tenses. And what I'm trying to do is I'm organizing information so that students from day one feel empowered to communicate, that they don't have to wait. We can already speak about somebody from day one. So I think that, as I said, Trevor, with the work that you're doing, or alluding to the work that you're doing, what you're inspiring people to do, to organize things, to find the connection and group them, is crucial, because that's an act of curation. That's the art of curation of everything that we share with students, because we are really easing the way and preventing them from start choosing what to say, what not to say, what to use, what not to use. We are giving them curated content. So that's high quality already.
Mm, love that. And so you touched on it a little bit, your final word, contribution. So can you tell us a little bit more about why you chose that word and what it means?
Absolutely, Julie. Well, you know, we learn a language, as we were saying at the beginning, because we want to communicate. Mm-hmm. But I think that if we want to communicate, we want to communicate something, and we want to contribute with something to the world. Mm-hmm. Never in my life, when I was a monolingual, did I think that I was going to be writing papers in English, academic papers. Never in my life did I think that I was going to be writing a blog that is now over 15 years old in English, helping a lot of language teachers like me that use English as a medium of instruction. And I think we really have to start seeing students with that potential, Julie. I mean, not only in languages, but in every other area of knowledge, as people that will contribute eventually. If we fail to see students as future contributors, then we are really just seeing them as recipients. But these ideas, these understandings that we share with them, they have to go somewhere else. They have to take and reach new heights through transformation, through evolution. And it will be these learners of the present, contributors of the future, that will be reshaping these ideas so that they adjust to their future realities. Imagine what would have happened to us if we had not become divergent thinkers, if we had not inquired into differences and just continued using content and conceptual understandings and skills from the past in the same way that our parents did. The evolution would have happened as rapidly. That's why contribution is important to me. There has to be an instrumental value behind everything that I put in front of students. Mm-hmm. These will empower you to do something. If you write a poem, that's your contribution to make somebody reflect. If you write a song, that's your contribution to entertain somebody. If you write a novel, that's your contribution to possibly reshape the way that literary genres are developed.
Contribution is big. I love it. It's so aligned to what we talk about as like authentic audiences and students sort of doing something authentic in the real world scenarios. And so I think that this generation of kids, that's what they want to do. So it's also a great motivator. So I love that. I think that's enormous. Would you say, because I heard you say eventually, so I'm just curious, would you say they have to wait, say kids take like 2 semesters, 3 semesters of a language. Do you have to wait until the second or the third semester, or would you say there's something that even beginners can contribute?
I think beginners can contribute that, Julie. Let's use music. You know, there's some very simple, beautiful songs that only use the verb to be.
Right.
And that's it. You know, that's a contribute to be or not to be. There you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, that philosophical expression, that's already something, a maxim that all of us say. Mm-hmm. So no, we don't have to wait. I think we really need to understand or begin or continue to observe individuals as somebody that has a purpose, somebody that has the need of communicating something. Mm-hmm. We all have a message to share with the world. Mm-hmm. And the sooner we teach children to develop that voice, to communicate it, the better students we're going to be forming. We don't have to wait. Many times waiting is what kills the magic.
I love that. And something I'm thinking about as we're talking, wow, wouldn't it be powerful for language teachers to survey their students, ideally before the year starts, to say, what do you like to talk about? And we can infer something that I advocate for we work with a middle school in Manila, and I advocated that they think about middle schoolers. What do middle schoolers want to talk about? Pop culture. They want to talk about sports. They want to talk, we can sort of infer some things that they want to talk about. But I love that you surveyed students. And so wouldn't it be so powerful to survey your students to say let's do units based on the topic.
Exactly, because that's one of the magical things about teaching a language, Julie, that we are not bound by content. We borrow content from any area of knowledge. If you want to speak about arts, okay, what discipline of the arts? If you're fascinated by science, okay, let's start by the classification of plants and things like that. Anything has a place in language teaching. We only need to be flexible and willing. Willing is a big part, because many people may say, but there are no resources for that and you don't need them. The only thing that we need is to listen to children an engaging conversation. Because if I go out for coffee with you, with both of you, I don't think I will need to read a book on how to talk to Julie and Trevor. No. I will just use what I know in my communication skills to really exchange messages with you. So I think that for me, that means a lot. How can I help my students to exchange messages rather than to imitate drills?
Yeah, and I think that the imitation versus the sort of authentic, more authentic ways of knowing is something that's really important. And I think that's kind of the focus of the disciplinary literacy chapter of our next book, is really being reflective about what is the role, function, and purpose of this content that we are delivering to students. Let me rephrase that. What is the role, purpose, and function of this discipline in terms of how it understands and produces knowledge, as opposed to what is the content that I need to deliver to my students? And I think that reframe is massively important, because it really changes the way that we think about and approach our content. It makes us more reflective of where do we want students to go? What do we want students to do with what we teach them, as opposed to what do we want students to, you know, to memorize and regurgitate? So I think that's really powerful.
Exactly. Yeah, many times, you know, with a topic so simple as the house, Trevor, Julie, if we just push a little bit harder, if we just try to go a little bit beyond the typical expectation, we will end up talking about geography. We will end up talking about the way that people adapt and construct and build houses depending on the geographical location in which they live, depending on the weather, depending on their family, their family systems. It's just a matter of going a little bit beyond, not just teaching you the parts of the house and that's the story. No. Where is that house located? Who lives in it? Why do they live together? Mm-hmm. There's so much behind the house that if we are only willing, again, to see beyond, we should be able to see these connections, these relationships.
I love that, because what you're doing is, so kids probably know the language of the house, like if you're teaching them, you know, basic furniture, vocabulary or something, but almost perceiving of what a house means in a new way. So if we're talking about, you know, 12-year-olds, for example, learning and thinking about, like you said, the language of the house, what does home mean? What are all the sort of cultural ties? What are all the values there? And I do want to say, in my experience, I'm curious about yours. Yours is more targeted towards language learning. Around the world, there are a lot of bright spots that the idea of really rigid, the way I went through Spanish, is I'm seeing that mostly fading out, that people are looking for pattern recognition, that people are asking students to think about more sort of meatier topics like the home. That was an example that I saw at a school 2 years ago. However, I still think you're very much a vanguard, very much on the cutting edge of all of this. What are you seeing sort of around the world, trends in language acquisition? Are you seeing some bright spots? Or are you seeing still a lot of work to be done?
I see that some people are letting go, Julie, letting go of the curriculum that binds us and have started listening to children and designing curriculum for children. And I'll bring back this idea of intellectually offending children because of something that I noticed in my classes and in at a time that I was co-teaching with somebody. And I'll use the example of a house, because if I do not acknowledge that children who are in eighth grade, for example, have already learned about geography, have already learned about the weather, have already learned about materials and what constitutes a society, and I don't bring or I do not create an opportunity for them to say that in my Spanish class, I am failing them intellectually, because I am missing the chance for them to recycle. I am missing the chance for them to rehearse something. And this for me is what at present the teachers that are making this attempt of welcoming intellect, understanding that what constitutes part of students' passive language in other subjects is its essence for us. It's meat for us.
So yeah, aligning we, with aligning with other content areas. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this helps us see a lot the value of teaching to different ages. Mm-hmm. When we teach younger children, when they're learning the concept of number, pick on that, teach them mm-hmm. the numbers with that idea. Continue adding in Spanish, continue adding in French. Mm-hmm. Ask them to read equations, I don't know, operations. In Melbourne, we had, when I mentioned Judy, there was this question, how can we extend the life of topics that are so short as the alphabet and the numbers? And I said, have you ever read the periodic table of elements? Like, but that's chemistry. Like, yeah, but have you seen how many letters and numbers it has? It should give you work and practice for two or more lessons. And in a way, you're giving students a chance to practice chemistry. I think that the fear that some educators may say is that by bringing in content, we are teaching that content. But I don't think that should be regarded as that. No, we're practicing. We're just giving it room to exist in the language that students are acquiring. I think this is one of the ways in which a transfer happens in language, Julie, when we're able to bring information and ideas from our home language or our mother tongue into this new language. And we figure out whether it applies, whether things are expressed the same, and most of the time they are. And when you know that you can say one idea, you can express one idea in two different languages. I mean, that's like duplicated knowledge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you touched on it, but I just want to make sure, we reiterate this point that we're finding a lot of research around multilingual and the brain and the value of learning multiple languages for just overall sort of intellectualism, overall quality of thinking, overall, like you said, divergent thinking, agility of thinking. And so that's something that I say to my kids all the time, because they're bilingual and they're truly bilingual. And we have to keep it up now that we're back in the United States, because otherwise they'll forget it. And so sometimes, I say cartoons in Spanish and they're like, and they're only 4 and 6, but they're already kind of like, oh, mom. And I'm like, who am I doing this for? Who am I asking you to do this for? And they're like, oh yeah, me. And it was great because, here in the States, Spanish is so ubiquitous. So we're doing some painting of our house, and the guy painting our house does not speak English. And so my dad was over there checking it out, and he had to call me to put me on speakerphone so that I could communicate with the painter. And so I was able to say to my kids, do you want to be like your grandfather who can't communicate, or do you want to be like me? And they're like you. And I was like, yeah, so watch your cartoons in Spanish. But I think, what you said brings it in really nice. I really want to play with this idea more, that it's not just utilitarian to be able to speak. Like, that was my story there with that particular example is utilitarian. Like, I can communicate my message, but you said in the beginning, you want it to be exploratory. You want students to sort of, view your students as humans, who view this other language sort of as other humans, and getting to know each other's value systems. You also use the word narratives. I just have so many notes that I've jotted down here that I want to pursue more. So we might have to have a Rafael Angel part 2 on this podcast, I think, because there's still,
that would be lovely.
There's still so much more to explore. But where can, just sort of one thing we always like to ask people, because you mentioned your blog, you mentioned your books, but where can listeners find you? Especially, I imagine a lot of listeners have Spanish language in their classrooms. So I just want to make sure you let them know about the books that you have. They're absolutely gorgeous. They're fully concept based. And so I just am a huge endorser of your textbooks
you've
written. So can you share for our listeners, where can they find more information?
Well, I have a very active persona on Twitter that mm-hmm. they can find me on Twitter at @JRafaelAngelM. That's mm-hmm. my Twitter handle. Mm-hmm. I have two YouTube channels, one for students and one for teachers. Mm-hmm. And it's JRafaelAngel, both of them. Rafael Angel, that's how I would pronounce it in Spanish. Mm-hmm. The one for students is completely in Spanish. The one for teachers is in English, where I share some of the tools that I designed for colleagues. I have 3 blogs. I started with one, which was my reflections, but then I I've become so many things that I just said, you know, I have to separate them. Mm-hmm. So one, and all of them are in WordPress, is Rafangel. That's my name and last name together. Mm-hmm. That's the oldest one. That's where I share my reflections and where I kind of experiment with ideas. And then I have one for English where I share all my concept-based ideas. That's Voices and Accents at WordPress.com. And then the other one in Spanish, con y sin acento, WordPress.com. And so I'm catering to different audiences, and you could tell in the names, you know, that the word accent means a lot to me, as well as does voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my books are Spanish for the NYP by Concept. The second edition was released yesterday. So actually, so
I am in that celebration.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, so they're for MYP, they're for the International Baccalaureate Middle Years Program. But I tell people all over the world so that no matter what, if you teach secondary Spanish or even upper elementary, they're such, just by at least one for the teacher, just such great resources because they, all the things that we talked about, they are so illustrative of how to get students to have these meatier conversations in the language. So they're so great.
Yes. And and actually, Julie, the second edition, one of the things that I try to do is to make them flexible for people who are not in the International Baccalaureate. Mm-hmm. So if they're teaching AP, if they're teaching IGCSE, you know, whatever framework they're teaching, you know, they will need very little adaptation or no adaptation at all.
They're excellent. Yes. Very cool.
Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Rafael. And I'm thinking back to a quote on one of our first episodes from Ken Gordon. I don't know if he was citing someone or not, but he said that the polyglot is a freer man. And I think that this conversation today has really kind of pointed to that. The fact that your access and understanding of these different languages allow you to take on different personas, which I think is just a beautiful way to think about language and communication and why it's important and vital, I think, in our increasingly globalized world to take on more than one language. So we really appreciate your time and the conversation. I agree with Julie. I would love a part two at some point.
Oh, no. I thank you, both of you, for the conversation. You know, that's one of the things that MasterCard cannot pay. And especially this kind of quality conversation that is very well-intentioned, that has a very concrete direction. That's what you guys do. That's the gift of your work, that you have a clear purpose and you have a clear contribution to make. So I applaud you. I salute you for that. And I thank you for welcoming me, for inviting me to be a part of this journey of yours. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Trevor.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rafael.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning the Transfers.